Hi, this is Jason Fitzgerald, and I'm joined today by Alex Hutchinson. Alex is an award-winning journalist, and he's also the author of Which Comes First, Cardio or Weights? So, Alex, thank you for joining us today.
It's great to be here, Jason.
So, Alex, can you tell us a little bit about your background with running and also how you got started writing about running and exercise science?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I started running back as a little kid, and I ran through high school and college. And I actually competed on the Canadian national team for a few years after college. So I was first a middle distance runner, like 1500 meters, 5000 meters, and later ran some longer stuff like 10K. And I really enjoyed cross country. Career wise, I started out as a physicist. Actually, I spent about a decade as a research physicist, and then became a journalist. I went back and did a master's in journalism. And so when I was starting out in journalism, they tell you, write what you know, and the things I knew were running and science. And so at first I was writing about those separately, but eventually I brought them together. And so that worked out really well, both for me because it was something I was really interested in, but also it turned out that there's a lot of research about running that's going on in universities around the world that often doesn't make it to the public. So I sort of found my niche as a guy who reads this research and talks to the scientists and talks to the coaches and the runners and then writes about it. And that's what I've been doing since about 2007. And these days I'm a columnist at Runner's World magazine. I read a monthly column there and also have a blog called Sweat Science, where basically, you know, 3-4 times a week I find an interesting study that has something to do with the science of fitness or training or health or running in particular, and kind of try and dissect the study, show the data and what it might mean for runners out there.
Yeah, and I would definitely recommend any listeners here, if you haven't checked out the Sweat Science blog on Runner's World, and I think it's runnersworld.com/sweat-science.
Yeah, that dash in there is just to make sure that half the people get the wrong web address. But no, you can also find a link usually from the Runner's World main page. There'll be a link to my latest blog entry on the left-hand side, so you can also find it from there.
Yeah, and one of the things that I really love about your work, Alex, is that you answer a lot of the questions that are really popular in just popular culture. It seems like every runner has these questions. You know, I have your book right here, and, you know, just from the back cover, should I exercise when I'm sick? Do I get the same workout from the elliptical that I get from running? And, you know, on and on and on, all these questions that runners have that come up when they're training for their respective races. So it's really great to read your book and read your blog and just kind of see what the science says about, you know, these really big topics that everyone seems to be asking about.
Well, I should jump into, I mean, thanks for those kind words, and I should jump in and say that sometimes, in many cases, science's answers to those good questions are very incomplete. And so that's another thing I really try and be careful about is understanding the limits of what when it's a science and when it's an art. So things like, you know, running when you're sick, there are some really fascinating studies about that where they actually, you know, infected undergraduates with you know, flu viruses or cold viruses, and then watched which ones got sick depending on how much they exercised. So there is some good research out there, but it's not. But in that question and in many others, it still ends up being a judgment call. So you have to have common sense combined with a little bit of science. So hopefully that's what we get out of these sorts of questions.
Right, and every runner should always listen to their own body. I think that's a general rule that every runner can adhere to. So, okay, let's jump into our questions. I have 7 questions from our runners here, and they run the spectrum from really focused training type of questions to hydration and fueling and injuries. So let's start with a question from Brian. Brian asks, do you have any training advice for an older guy in his late 50s who wants to specialize in the mile? In this particular example, Brian is 58 and has recently run a 6:24 mile, but he's curious to see how fast he can get. Are there different types of training that he should focus on at this stage in his life? And it's also helpful to know that, you know, he ran in high school and, you know, he ran a 2-minute half mile, but then he took, you know, about 20 to 25 years off, and he's just been getting back into it over the last couple of years.
Oh, well, that's really great. I mean, that's a very impressive performance, both in high school and for the mile. Given that he has a background having run in high school, he's probably familiar with interval workouts, but really the bread and butter, if you want to run a mile, is interval workouts like, you know, 400 meter, 10 times 400 meters with, you know, a minute or 2 minutes of rest, depending on, you know, you can do it a number of different ways. And the difference is that, you know, as you get older, as a 20-year-old, maybe you do three interval workouts a week or something like that, depending on how resilient you are. You can't keep doing that. So I would say, depending on how his personal training is going, you know, making sure to get one really good interval workout like that a week in, where you're trying to run, you know, if not at goal mile pace, then certainly pretty close to it. And for a second workout per week, then it you kind of have to play it by ear, maybe like a tempo run or some longer intervals, like 3 or 4 or 5, you know, maybe 4 by a mile, where you're not going quite as fast. At least as I've gotten older, you know, I'm 37 right now, and I used to run the mile, and I find I personally can't recover from those interval workouts as well as I used to be able to, and so injury is not just injury but also just being recovered enough to get the other runs in the week in. If I do too many interval workouts, that's a danger. So I would say one really hard interval workout, or at least really goal pace interval workout, one other hard workout. And then the other thing I would recommend is some sort of weight training. That doesn't necessarily mean, you know, lifting barbells. It could be something like plyometrics, where doing a little bit of jumping, you know, either even just two-legged hops, things like that, or bounding, or working in the weight room, just doing squats and lunges, maybe with a little bit of weight. Because the big thing for older runners is you know, really once you're in your 30s, you're losing muscle mass, and you're also losing not just muscle mass, you're losing, even if you have the same amount of muscle mass as you get older, you're getting weaker. The signals from your brain to your muscles aren't traveling as efficiently. So I would say, you know, as far as training goes, as I was talking about before, you're trying to do some sort of version, the closest version you can of what a younger miler would do, things like 400 meter repeats. But what you have to add is some strength to keep your legs, not just, you know, your arms are important too, but to keep that strength in your legs, doing some sort of plyometric or strength routine. Anyway, that's my long rambling answer of a few keys to keep in mind for mile racing.
I think that's really helpful. Now, you mentioned plyometrics, and I think that's interesting, because do you think that there's a bigger risk for an older runner to do more plyometric-oriented exercises? And would you sort of balance that risk by maybe replacing some of that plyometric work with safer weight training in the gym?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that plyometrics, you know, I mentioned bounding, and that's something I would probably, you know, as I think about it, for someone in their 50s, unless they're really experienced with it, bounding's probably not a good idea. That being said, I think that there's a big misconception about plyometrics, because when we train for running or weight training, the idea is you want to train to failure, or you want to train until you're really, 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 really tired. And so people tend to apply that idea to plyometrics too. Whereas what the research shows is really it takes only a very, very light dose of plyometrics to get some sort of benefit. To really what you're trying to do with plyometrics is improve the signal from your brain to your muscles. So, you know, something I do once a week when I'm doing weights is I just, from 2 feet, I just jump in the air 10 times in a row. And each jump, I try and jump as high as I can. And, that, you know, that's a little bit tiring, but that's not something I find to be a big injury risk. And I don't, you know, I could do 6 sets of 10 reps, but I do 1 set of 10 reps. So I totally agree with you that probably working with weights is a lower risk approach than doing plyometrics. But I think it is possible if you're conservative in how you approach plyometrics. It is possible to do some fairly low injury risk exercises that can still have benefit, because the key to remember is for plyometrics, and by plyometrics we're talking about body weight exercises that involve some explosive motion, you don't need to be pushing yourself to some sort of fatiguing limit, which is where the real injury risk comes in. So even some relatively modest number of jumps can just remind your brain how to, you know, with running, you're never really calling on every muscle fiber in your leg, whereas with a jump, you can kind of improve those connections between your brain and your muscles.
Great. That's a really good point.
Yeah.
And especially since you mentioned that plyometrics have the main goal of improving that mind-body connection, then, you know, that should be a good signal to runners that they don't need to go to failure or exhaustion, because it's not the same type of workout as if you were on the track doing, a repetition workout or some sort of VO2 max workout.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so I think that's a good, since we were talking about recovery, I think that's a good transition to a question from Ashley. She asks, after a particularly high mileage week or even a long run or a hard workout, what are the best ways to recover? There seems to be 101 different ways to boost recovery, so it's never super clear what runners should really focus on.
Yeah, that's a fascinating question with a lot of debate these days. I will start by saying that one of the best ways of recovering from a run is going to bed and waking up the next morning and doing it again. And the reason I say that is we spend a lot of energy and effort thinking about all these different ways of recovering, whether it's ice baths or massages or foam rollers. It's worth thinking about a little thought experiment. What if you were really, really good at recovery? You had all the fancy tools, the pneumatic, automatic leg massagers and everything, so that you could make your 1 hour run feel like, as far as your body is concerned, you would only run for 45 minutes. Then the question you have to ask is, you know, why wouldn't you just run for 45 minutes? Because in some sense, the fatigue that you get from running, you know, when your legs are sore, that's a response to the stress you've just put it under. And those damage markers in your muscles are exactly what signals to your body to get stronger, to adapt, and say, hey, we have to rebuild better so that next time we endure this stress, we won't suffer so much damage. So all of which is to say there's a bit of a danger in putting too much emphasis on recovery, because the point of training is to be tired and then to adapt to it. So there's a bit of a trend these days, or at least an idea that's been going around for the past few years among elite runners, to periodize recovery. So during periods of heavy training, when what you're trying to do is get fitter, you try not to overuse recovery modalities like ice baths, because you want to allow that damage to happen and to feel that fatigue and to know that you're getting stronger as a result. And then as you get closer to a race, that's when you want to ramp up recovery modalities. And because then, in the last, 3-4 weeks before a race, the goal is no longer quite so much to adapt and get fitter. It's to recover and make sure you're at 100%. So that's something to think about. I haven't actually answered the question, which is what's the best way to recover. There are a lot of different approaches to recovering when you are tired. Because sometimes, let's say you have a particularly heavy week, and to the point that and you do a really hard workout, and you really do need to accelerate the recovery, otherwise you're not going to be able to run the next day or something. The science behind the recovery is still very preliminary. There's a lot of debate as to whether things like ice baths really work, or whether it's an effect that's more in the mind. Personally, if I were choosing between different recovery modalities, I would definitely stay away from any form of like a pill, like anti-inflammatories or painkillers. That's a terrible idea, and that hinders the adaptation to training. There's not a lot of evidence that antioxidants do much good. I would think eating right after a hard workout is a good idea. You know, if you're training hard, then making sure you get in some carbohydrates and protein. The usual advice is a ratio of about 4-to-1 in terms of the amount of carbohydrates to protein. That's why people talk about chocolate milk, because it just happens to have that 4-to-1 carb to protein ratio. Ice baths are good. Personally, in my running, I haven't used ice baths in a long time, but when I did use them, I did find after a hard workout, I felt better the next day after an ice bath. Whether that was in my mind or my body, it's likely a mix of the two. So an ice bath is a great idea. There's some good evidence that massage helps. So these are things you can use when you need them. But I guess to go back to my original point, the goal is to be tired. That's what we're training to fatigue our bodies. And so if there's something that's, I think recoveries and things like massage and icing are super important for injury prevention. But if it's just a question of I'm going to be tired tomorrow, that's a good idea. And if you're training at such a level that your workouts leave you basically like unable to walk the next morning, that's not a problem. That's not a recovery problem. That's a problem that you're training too hard, that you're not managing your training appropriately if you're consistently, hobbling around the next day after a workout. So anyway, those are a few thoughts. I realize that's a bit scattered.
No, that's great. I think it really bears repeating that it's okay to be fatigued. It's okay to have some soreness. That's why we train. And, and just another point for Ashley, I think is really interesting that you hit on, was that a lot of runners think that they need those recovery modalities like ice baths and, foam rolling and massage and all that after a really hard workout or a long run. But, like you mentioned, a lot of the elite runners now are periodizing that recovery. So I actually recommend to my runners that if they are going to use an ice bath and they have that option of choosing when to do it, I would do it on their recovery day. So if they have a day a week where they're only running a couple miles, they're not doing any strenuous strength work, I like to throw in the ice bath on that day. So, that's a really, that's a true recovery day, and they're getting as much recovery as possible out of that one day. And then, of course, it's just, make sure you're getting your sleep every night.
Yeah, no, that can't be over.
Like everyone skips that one.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense what you say. And yeah, for sure, I should have emphasized that more, is that the number one thing you can do is sleep well and manage the stress in your life. That's easier said than done, obviously, but recovery is more than just the half hour after your run. It's everything you do during the day.
And I think that's why I think Ryan Hall, who's a U.S. Elite marathoner, he calls his daily nap a business meeting because it really is an integral part of his training.
I'd like to institute the same policy. I
wish we could all take naps in the middle of the afternoon.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have a similar question from Brendan about, what advice or recovery strategies do you have about delayed onset muscle soreness? He doesn't seem to have any problems after a hard workout or long run, but the next day he really struggles to feel normal, and he does hobble around a little bit. And I think you've really already answered this question, because you were talking about, that's probably not a recovery issue. That's probably a training issue.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy to say that. Sometimes you feel like you're doing everything right and you still end up sore the next morning, and that's fine. Now, first of all, we should say delayed onset muscle soreness. That's totally normal. It is delayed. You should, if you do exercise that kind of damages your muscle fibers, and that's particularly if you're doing something unusually hard, downhill running is a real killer if you have a course that has more downhill than you're used to. For some reason, the damage tends to peak between 24 and 48 hours after. And researchers are still arguing over exactly what causes this kind of soreness. They used to say it was just that the muscle fibers got kind of torn or disrupted, and then they would swell up the next day. But it's not entirely clear. There's a bunch of processes going on, but essentially it seems to be that it's not the damage that really hurts. It's the repair that happens on a slower time scale when the cells that come in to repair the muscle fibers, they do more damage and cause this swelling because fluid leaks out of the cells. And that's what you're feeling the day after. the thing is with delayed onset muscle soreness, to some extent, it's true that once you've done the damage, you can't undamage those muscles. So, you know, things like icing and ice baths and massage, they may be able to play a little role in controlling the swelling. But fundamentally, you can't. If you don't want delayed onset muscle soreness, what you need to do is not damage the muscles. And the way to do that is to get the muscles used to that stimulus. There's something called the repeated bout effect, where, you know, if I I don't do a lot of bicep curls, say. So if I went down to the gym right now and did some heavy bicep curls, I would be really sore tomorrow. But if I did the same thing then next week, I probably wouldn't. I would be less sore. And if I did it the week after that, I wouldn't be sore at all, because it takes very little to get your muscles used to a particular activity. Now, it's when you're running, if you're out for a 2-hour long run, then sometimes you're going to get sore no matter what. Or for instance, if you run a marathon, it doesn't matter how many times you've run, you're still going to be beyond the limit of what your muscles are used to, and you're going to be sore the next day. So, but again, as we were talking about before, in general, in training, you want to be progressing in such a way, in a gradual way, that you're not, ideally, that you're not ending up with this great amount of soreness on a regular basis. If it happened, you know, let's say at the beginning of you're starting your build up for a race, and you're doing your first few long runs of a marathon build up, then maybe you're going to experience some soreness then. But if you're experiencing significant delayed onset muscle soreness, like every Monday the day after your Sunday long run, and every Thursday the day after your Wednesday interval workout, then it seems like there's likely something else going on at that point. You know what I mean? Like either there's something with your stride that's making you more susceptible to muscle damage, or you're just pushing beyond what your training is really set up for. Having said all that, like, again, just to if you do get the muscle soreness, or if you are trying to avoid it, I do think an ice bath is one way of doing it. But it just I would like to think that it's not something you have to rely on every week to get through the training week.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things that you mentioned that, you know, I'd love to echo is, you know, you can't undo the damage that you've done to your leg muscles after a hard workout. And a lot of these recovery tools that you have at your disposal, like ice baths or going to get a massage, they're not actually going to help rebuild and repair your muscles. So none of those things do any repair work. Only your body is going to be able to do that repair work. And the best way that you have to kind of facilitate that repair is to get a lot of sleep.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe eat a really, really great diet and stay hydrated.
Yeah, and learn your lesson and say, next time I'm going to try and make sure I don't. I only go 10% beyond my limits instead of 50%, so I don't do quite as much damage. Because the more damage you do, you know, the longer it takes before you're ready to do another hard session.
Yes, exactly. Okay, that's great. Okay, let's transition a little bit to some strength work. So regarding a post-run strength workout, is it more beneficial to do this kind of work immediately after the run itself? Or if you simply don't have time, can you complete that strength work later in the day when you do have time without any negative consequences?
Yeah, you know, that. I mean, this is an area with lots of debate and people researching various combinations of workouts. So don't let me pretend that I have definitive answers here. But my feeling is that if you were purely trying to optimize the training effect, you'd actually be better off to do them at different times, like to do your run in the morning and do your weights in the evening, because you're going to have had a little chance to recover and you're going to get more out of the weights. Now, for me, I've always done my weights right after a run, you know, just for logistical reasons. You know, there's only so many times a day that you want to shower and that you can take the time to exercise. So you have to balance what's realistic with what's convenient, and what, you know, the best workout plan is the one you're going to follow, right? As opposed to the one you say, this is theoretically perfect, but I'm going to miss my workout, you know, two times out of every three because I'm setting myself up for something that's not convenient. So, in terms of the ideal, again, I don't think really with your weights you're trying to do something different than what you're trying to do with the run. So stacking them back to back, sure, it makes it a little bit harder, but having time to recover between them probably means you're going to be able to lift a little bit more weight for the same amount of effort, and so you're maybe going to get a little bit more adaptation out of it. But so anyway, that's I guess my overall message is probably the number one thing is to do what's convenient and what you can fit into your day, and it's not going to make a big difference either way. But I certainly wouldn't worry about doing them at two different times if that's what fits best into your day.
Now, does your answer change at all if that strength workout is an easier body weight strength workout that's maybe 10 or 15 minutes of core exercises or, you know, just more body weight oriented type of work?
It doesn't change fundamentally. I mean, if it's something like that, then I would say it's all the more convenient to do it right after. I mean, it just makes sense that you've run, you're sweaty, and now you're going to do this body weight oriented exercise. But I think we could have a good discussion about this, and I'm sure there are lots of people who might see it slightly differently. I just if I'm doing some push-ups and some sit-ups and, you know, whatever, core work and pull-ups, fundamentally that I'm not trying to, it's not an endurance workout. I guess if you're doing leg strength, then there might be some benefit to doing that right after running, when your legs are sort of pre-fatigued from the run. But to me, it's like going back to the plyometrics. You know, when you're doing plyometrics, your goal is to, you're worried about the connection between the mind and the muscle. So it doesn't really matter whether or not your heart has been pumping, or even whether the legs themselves are a little bit fatigued, because you're working on something different. And so when we run, obviously, you know, running isn't a purely aerobic activity, and strength training also isn't a purely muscular activity. It has aerobic. So there's definitely overlap between the two. But in terms of what we're fundamentally hoping to get out of it, when I'm doing strength work, I'm trying to get my muscles stronger. And when I'm running, I'm sure there's, you know, my leg muscles might be active, but fundamentally I'm trying to tax my aerobic system. And so the two are different enough that I guess overall I think it just doesn't, whatever arguments you might make for or against doing them back to back, I think the effect is relatively minor because they're just different workouts. I don't know. I mean, I'd certainly be interested in hearing other perspectives, but that's my sort of instinct that it's not, that convenience is probably a bigger factor than whether you get a slightly bigger adaptation from doing it when you're tired.
Right. I'm a big proponent of doing, you know, a more convenient workout as long as you're still getting the stimulus that you're looking for, especially with, you know, recreational runners and age groupers who have to fit in running with the rest of their life, and they don't have the entire day to train with a completely free schedule. Argument I've heard for doing that kind of strength work right after a run is that it does help continue the aerobic stimulus of the run if you don't wait a long time and you kind of do it right after the workout itself, the running workout. So I have heard that, and as long as the strength work isn't so taxing that you're compromising your form or anything like that, then, you know, I've heard it's more beneficial to do it right after the run itself.
Yeah, I mean, that makes it, if you're looking for an aerobic stimulus out of your weights, then stacking it with the run is useful. I guess even though I tend to do my strength training almost circuit style, where I'm keeping it going. I don't have time to stand around taking 3 minute breaks between sets, so it's slightly aerobic. But there is research into sort of how much of an aerobic stimulus is a strength workout or a circuits routine. And the truth is it's not much of one. Like, unless you're really, really, you know, you've got like a drill sergeant standing behind you saying, okay, you only have 8 seconds rest between each exercise. Most people struggle to get up above 50% VO2 max in any sort of weights routine. So there may be a little bit of benefit to, you know, if you're doing a 40-minute run and then you're doing 15 minutes of circuits, then you stack them together and you have 55 minutes where your heart is elevated. There's definitely something to that. I think for most people, there's not all that much of an aerobic stimulus coming from the weights anyway. So it's not a big deal if it's more convenient for them to do those circuits, you know, after dinner instead or something like that. But I certainly see what you're saying.
Yeah, and it's interesting too because actually the last gym workout I did, I strapped on a heart rate monitor just because I'm a geek like that, and my heart rate probably got up to what it would be during an easy distance run for, I'd say, about 10% of the total gym workout. So you're right that you really – and I do it more circuit style too because I don't really like being – I'd rather be running. I don't like being in the gym. So I try to get in there, do what I need to do, and get out as fast as I can. And you're right. The amount of time that my heart rate was up, especially with heavy weights, was relatively low compared to, you know, where you would probably think it would be.
Yeah, like it feels hard, right? Like you're lifting weights. You may be tired the whole time, and you may be at a very high sense of perceived effort. It's just a different kind of effort. So, you can get a little bit of an aerobic thing, but I think it's almost better to just sort of say, I run, you know, I get my aerobic from running, and when I'm doing weights, it's very important. It's not necessarily aerobically challenging, but it's challenging in a lot of other ways that are going to help me, and so I don't need to stress about whether my heart rate is up or down in that scenario.
Absolutely. Okay, let's move on to our next question. Teresa has a question about the treadmill. If a runner is forced to train on the treadmill for a significant portion of their total volume, are there any modifications that you would make to their training with respect to pace or the workouts or even the total mileage?
That's an interesting question. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind with doing a majority of training on treadmill is just the difference in surfaces. The sort of classic thing is you train on a treadmill all winter and then you go out and do a 10K on the roads or, you know, without much transition. And it's just, it's a different surface. You're a little more pounding on the roads you're more likely to feel muscle fatigue in the legs just because all training is specific, right? Like you whatever you do in training, that's what you're best prepared for. And running on the roads is just different enough from running on the treadmill that it can be hard to make that transition. So the first thing I would do is if you have race goals, try and give yourself a couple weeks at least, and some key workouts where you're doing it on the surface you're going to be racing on, and that goes for any kind of race, whether it's if you're racing on the track or if you're racing on roads or if you're racing in the mountains or trails. Make sure you do some training on the surface you're going to race on. Beyond that, I mean, I guess practically speaking, for the treadmill, I actually think it does a pretty good job of simulating or of matching what running outside is. And, you know, running is running and the treadmill is similar. So I don't think you necessarily need to do a different amount of mileage. There's various things you can do in terms of, you know, people often recommend putting the incline up to about 0.5% to compensate for the lack of wind resistance. So in other words, you make it a little bit harder on the treadmill by going slightly uphill. That'll give you a more realistic sense of the paces you're running at. But I guess one caveat that I would offer is not to believe the paces on treadmills too much. For one thing, a lot of them aren't calibrated very well, so they may just be flat out wrong. For another thing, it's just a fundamentally different experience to have a treadmill that is set at an exact speed and never varies, and you just have to stay on it, than to be out, on a lonely road, trying to maintain that pace. It takes a lot more mental effort to maintain your pace in the real world. So I don't know if there's anything specific you can do other than, you know, making sure you run outside sometimes, but more just to try and rely on try and learn to pay attention to your effort level or maybe your heart rate if you're into heart rate training, so that when you transition from treadmill to outside, don't assume that whatever pace you ran on the treadmill should feel exactly the same outside. Fundamentally, when you're racing, the race should be you're going as hard as you can. You're not that you're going at pace exactly XXX because the treadmill told you you could do it that way. So I guess just because you can dial in the pace on the treadmill, don't ignore your perceived effort, because that's what you're going to have to rely on when you go outside. And finally, in terms of workouts, I mean, I guess it depends on what race distance you're preparing for, but I've always found it's easier to do long intervals, like 5-minute intervals and tempo runs on a treadmill, than it is to try and do things like the equivalent of, you know, 1-minute reps or 2-minute reps at faster speeds. So I think you'll have better luck preparing for longer races, whether it's or building your endurance, you know, racing 10Ks or something or things like that. If you are interested in racing 5Ks or the mile for that matter, again, ideally you'll give yourself a chance to be able to get outside at least, you know, a few times a week, and then also for a few weeks before the race, where you can spend a little time running on the surface you're going to be racing on and at the race pace, especially if you're going to be doing some faster running, because faster running on a treadmill it's awkward, and there's the higher risk that you're going to slip and get shot off the back of the treadmill, which has happened to a few friends of mine.
Yeah, nobody wants that.
Yeah, it's no good.
And I know in this particular example, Teresa is training for a marathon, so she will be able to do some of the easier workouts, you know, for the treadmill, like the longer reps and the tempo runs. And, you know, I think it's really interesting that you mentioned the perceived effort on the treadmill, because I rarely run on a treadmill myself, but whenever I do, I find that I'm at least 30 seconds slower, because whether the treadmill is calibrated incorrectly or because it's a fundamentally different experience, I cannot run the same pace that I know that I run outside.
That's really interesting. I mean, I've heard people who have that experience, and I've also heard people who have exactly the opposite experience, especially people who spend a lot. I mean, I guess maybe it's specificity. People who spend a lot of time on the treadmill. I have a friend who did almost all his running on a treadmill and raced a few marathons a couple of years ago, and he was a beast on the treadmill. The workouts he would describe were just incredible, and he was very fit off the treadmill, but he couldn't do. On the roads, what he could do on the treadmill, and I should also, he also, I know, had muscle cramps in the later stages of the marathon, and there, you know, there could be many reasons for that, but I do think for a marathon, it's a great idea if you can get some of your long runs on the actual surface, because for marathon, the continuous pounding can be a real issue. And the treadmill is a forgiving surface, which is good, but doesn't give you quite as much preparation for pounding on the road. So, you know, there are people who have made Olympic marathon teams. You know, there was a woman from Alaska who made the Olympic marathon team a couple decades ago, training basically exclusively on a treadmill. So you can run very, very well. You can run a great marathon off the treadmill, but you can increase your odds if you can make sure you get some long sessions in outside occasionally. You know, it's certainly not all of them, but just make sure you're not stepping off the treadmill and straight to the start line. That could be a challenge.
Right. And I'd recommend, too, that in addition to the long run, if it's possible to get in any of the race pace specific workouts on the actual training surface of the race itself, then that would be kind of the ideal balance between the treadmill and also being outside.
Yeah, it's a great point.
Okay, let's move to a question from Don. He has a question about hydration and fueling. So what's the ideal way to determine both hydration and fueling during a marathon? He's read Tim Noakes' book Waterlogged and was curious about the risks of both overdrinking and underdrinking as well.
Yeah, this is a great topic, an interesting topic, and a topic where there's been a lot of debate and interesting research recently. So First of all, I just want to distinguish between hydration and fueling in general and doing it for a marathon. I would say for most people in most contexts, you don't ever need to be carrying a bottle with you for runs of less than, even 2 hours in training. And in fact, getting dehydrated when you're training is another one of those important stimuli that teach your body to adapt. So I do think a lot of people put more emphasis than they need to on, drinking during their training. That being said, a marathon is a whole different kettle of fish, and staying hydrated is important, but even more important is getting some carbohydrates in, and that's really why you need to have a hydration plan when you're racing a marathon, is because the best way to get carbohydrates into your system is to be drinking sports drink or drinking water with a gel or whatever is your preferred method. And the other thing is, in order to make that work during your marathon, you need to practice that in training. You can't just rock up to the start of a marathon and expect your gut to be ready to deal with sports drink through while you're racing. You're gonna say, oh, my stomach bothers me. I'm not comfortable drinking during the marathon. Well, everyone is like that, but you have to train. You have to train it. You have to, on your long runs and on some of your marathon pace sessions, practice drinking, practice taking gels, and get yourself ready for that. In terms of how much, first of all, I would say hyponatremia, very real danger, if over drinking, but very, very rare and unlikely to, and I don't mean any disrespect to the people who've had this before, but it's unlikely to affect people who've been training regularly and are, racing a marathon with the goal of a personal best. It mostly hits people who are taking a lot of time on the course and stopping at every drink station to drink a full drink, and also may have some pre-existing abnormality in their hydration hormones. So, if the reader has read Tim Noakes's waterlogged, I think he's very unlikely to end up being hyponatremic. So I guess I would say, yeah, just you don't force feed yourself fluids, and you'll probably be okay in terms of hyponatremia. In terms of calculating how much you need, that's a really interesting question. The sort of conventional wisdom was that you need that the body cannot absorb more than 60 grams of carbohydrate per hour. And lately that's been, with newer formulations of carbohydrate drinks, combining two different kinds of carbohydrate, there's some evidence that you can actually get in 90 grams an hour. But that's you can look at how many grams are in a bottle of sports drink and figure out how much that is. But that 90 grams an hour is a level that very few people can stomach comfortably. There's no point in gaining time if you then lose the time, waiting in a porta potty line halfway through the race. So I would say 60 grams an hour of carbohydrate is a pretty good goal. Even that, the vast majority of people don't achieve that, because it takes effort. And that will kind of determine how much you drink too. If you're going to get down 60 grams of carbohydrate, you will probably be drinking as much, as much per hour. You're not going to want to drink any more than that. In terms of just general hydration, I would say I do agree with Tim Noakes's basic point, which is that which is that thirst and dehydration are two different things. If you go for a run in hot conditions, you are going to lose some fluids. You're going to finish lighter than you started. But as long that doesn't necessarily mean there's a problem, because your body can compensate for that. What matters is when you're thirsty, you take a bit of a drink. And as long as you sort of follow your thirst, you'll be okay. But the problem is that I think that's true in general. The problem is that in a marathon, you can't always drink when you're thirsty, because there's only drink stations at every 5K or depending on the marathon. So it's not possible always to just drink according to thirst. So yeah, you have to have a bit of a plan. Think about how many grams of carbohydrate you'd like to get down, how much sports drink that will require, and then plan your plan accordingly and practice that plan accordingly. So anyway, that's very general advice. Hopefully that gives a few ideas.
Yeah, and I think the 60 grams of carbohydrate per hour, you know, if you were taking gels, just to quantify that, I think that's about 2 gels. And each gel packet is generally about 30 grams, give or take, maybe about 5.
Yeah, just to jump in on that, I would say that's like a high end. That's tough to get that much down. And it's, if you're going to be out there for 4 hours, great. If you're going to be out there for 6 hours, then, you know, at a certain point, I think you can't sustain that level for long. So don't try and take 60 grams an hour for more than 3 or 4 hours, I would say.
Okay, that's a great point. One of the other follow-up questions I had for you, Alex, was if you are getting your carbohydrate from gels and not from sports drinks, would you supplement with sports drinks on the course, or would you drink water? Because, you know, I think I might have read this on your blog, Sweat Science, but, you know, there's an idea that if you're consuming too many electrolytes and not enough actual water, then your body will start taking water from your body to process those electrolytes. Is there any truth to that, or what would you recommend?
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental issue is that you have to have roughly the right concentration of electrolytes in the stomach for it to pass through the stomach wall efficiently. So if you just take a gel and don't drink any water at all, it will be too concentrated and it'll just sit in your stomach. And if you take a gel and drink sports drink with it, you'll be closer to the right concentration, but you still won't be at that optimum kind of 6% level, which is the fastest that's absorbed. So if you're going to take gels, you should aspire to, it's, you know, it's not a perfect science, but there's an amount of water that is recommended, you know, a glass of water or whatever, or a bottle of water with each gel. You should aspire to drink roughly the appropriate amount of water. You can additionally take some sports drink, but you should take some water if you are taking gels, if you want to make sure that the carbohydrates in that gel get into your blood system and don't just sit in your stomach until the end of the race.
Great. I love how practical that is, and so many runners can just use that advice in their next marathon and throughout their training as well. Okay, so we're at our last question, and this is a great question to wrap up on. It's a good one from one of your fans. It's from Joy, and she read your book last year.
Awesome.
And was curious if there's any one particular finding that surprised you the most about running that would help someone who's trying to be a healthy, injury-free runner.
Ooh, that's a
broad question.
Yeah, any 10 surprising findings. In terms of things that were surprising, and especially when I wrote the book, let me say two things. One, from a health perspective, the thing that surprised me the most was the findings about the health risks of spending your whole day sitting at a desk. I had always assumed, and this is something that's been getting a little more attention lately, but when I wrote about it in Which Comes First, Cardio or Weights, it was just new. And basically, when you're totally motionless, like sitting at a desk, like I am right now, your muscle cells kind of go into a dormant mode, and that allows more fatty acids to circulate through the blood. And what they found is people who spend more time sitting without breaks have higher risk of heart disease and other serious conditions, totally independent of how much they exercise. So the fact that I run an hour a day half an hour a day and go to the gym, that has no bearing on the fact that it is unhealthy to sit motionless for, the entire day. So in terms of the practical, like, day-to-day things that I think change health and that have changed my day-to-day routine, I now, you know, I don't have a standing desk. That's expensive. I just have a little stand. I can stand up and put my laptop on this little stand at my desk. It's very simple. And so, you know, maybe 10 or 15 minutes every couple of hours, I'll stand up for a while, or even 10 minutes every hour, just work standing up. And that's not directly running related, but, you know, I think most runners are also interested in being healthy. And that's something that really changed my mind. In terms of specific running stuff and injury prevention, this is a bit of an oldie that was really new a couple of years ago and now is more familiar to a lot of people. It's the role of stretching. I guess I've been running for more than 20 years now, and for 10 of those years, I used to stretch religiously, pretty much every day, quite often twice a day, and I did a particular kind of stretching, static stretching. That basically involves, you know, holding a pose and reaching as far as I could to increase my range of motion. This is still a controversial topic about what the best kind of stretching is and when you should do it and what roles it plays in terms of strengthening and flexibility. But from the research that I've seen and then the sort of what elite runners are doing now, it just doesn't seem that static stretching is really relevant to runners, because most of us don't get injured while trying to touch our toes or at the extremes of our range of motion. So being able to do the splits a little bit more doesn't make much difference to runners. What matters is our dynamic flexibility, the ability to move through the range of motion that we use while running. So I've shifted from spending a lot of time, you know, trying to touch my toes to doing certain drills, you know, high knees and skips and things like that help prepare me to run and increase my flexibility, but in a dynamic way rather than a static way. And I have to say, you know, people talk about things like confirmation bias in where everyone likes to see conclusions that they already agree with in research. And I'm a little bit guilty of this here because I always hated stretching. And so I would say my life is much happier now that I have a bunch of research that tells me I can do these dynamic stretching drills instead of static stretching.
Well, there's a couple things I want to comment on there. First, about the sitting down. You know, I've written about this in the past, and, you know, it definitely got a lot of attention maybe about a year and a half ago. There were a lot of these crazy infographics out there that were kind of scaring people into not sitting down all day. But, you know, you mentioned the general health consequences of sitting down all day. But, you know, do you think there are any running-related consequences to sitting down, you know, for your day job, for example, and then, you know, going into a run or even a hard workout after work? Because one of the things that I'm, you know, trying to help runners with is, you know, if you do have a day job and you're sitting down all day, then the best way to prepare yourself for a post-work run is to make sure that, you know, you don't get super tight and sit down for 8 or 9 hours before that workout. You know, try to vary what you're doing, whether that's doing some standing up during the day, whether that's going for a 5-minute walk a couple times. You know, maybe you can get a standing desk, maybe you can sit on a Bosu ball or a physio ball. But, you know, I think one of the things that runners can do just to help them, you know, loosen up their hip flexors and make sure that they're not sitting down and weakening their glutes all day is just to vary what they're doing throughout the day, whether that's sitting, standing, kneeling. I know there's those ergonomic chairs that I've used in the past. You know, I don't own one myself, but if they're available, you know, I think using them, you know, occasionally can be a helpful tool for runners, especially if they run after work.
Yeah, that's a really fantastic point. I have to say, you know, I read all this research about standing up and the dangers of sitting, and for a couple of years it just didn't take for me. Like, I understand it in theory, but I do not want to stand up when I'm working, and I'm not really that worried about this kind of stuff. I'm young and invincible and so on.
We all are.
Yeah, exactly. I finally tried it, and you know what has helped me stick with it, I think, the most is realizing how much more comfortable, like, feeling my hamstrings and things like that. It used to be one, you know, as I think a lot of people, after you sit down at the end of the day, I'm getting uncomfortable from being sitting, and I'm shifting my position, I'm putting my legs out and trying to get comfortable. And what I found is now if I just stand up for 10-15 minutes, I stretch everything out and it feels good. And I don't want to stand up all day either. Like you said, variety is the key. And so after 15, 20 minutes, I'm starting to get tired of standing up. I sit back down and I'm way more comfortable than I was before. Because I've varied my position. And so by the end of the day, if I'm going for a run, I think I'm in a much better place, rather than having been locked into this one position all day. So I think that's an excellent point.
Great. And then with the stretching, I couldn't agree more. I used to be exactly the same way as you. I thought stretching helps you recover. I thought it helped you prepare for a run, but it looks like the research doesn't show that. And, you know, I frankly tell my runners not, you know, I say you don't have to stretch at all if you don't want to. And if you are going to stretch, if you do like to stretch, then let's do it at the very end of your workout. You know, let's do it after the run, after any strength workout, and then, you know, just do it lightly. You don't have to sit there for 20 minutes. I think there are some negative consequences to overstretching, but, you know, some light stretching I don't think is harmful in any way. Do you find in any of your research that it's harmful after the workout itself if you don't overdo it?
No, not at all. In terms of there's a little bit of evidence that if you do it right before the workout, it can make you less efficient and less strong. But if you do it after the workout, no negative effects at all. And lots of people love it. I mean, let's say you're a kindergarten teacher and you have to spend time sitting cross-legged on the floor, then you sure as heck want to be flexible. Or if you play, you know, if you're a ballerina or a hockey goaltender, or if you just like being flexible, hey, that's great. It's not that it's necessarily bad. It's just you don't have to do it, and that's a big relief for some people.
Okay, well, Alex, those are the questions that were submitted by our runners, and you know, I interjected some follow up questions that I was interested in. So thank you so much for taking the time to help our runners and even help me. I always learn something when I read your blog, Sweat Science, and I can't recommend your book, Which Comes First, Cardio or Weights, enough. So is anybody listening who hasn't read it, definitely pick it up. It's available on Amazon, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Yeah, that's the best place.
Okay. Well, Alex, thanks again. And, you know, if people are curious about your work or want to learn more about you, what's the best place to find you online?
Probably my personal website, which is alexhutchinson.net. Unfortunately, some 11-year-old in New Jersey got alexhutchinson.com, but you can find links to my blog there and stuff like that. But you know, thanks a lot for having me, Jason. It was really really fun to chat about these issues, which are you know, these are all great questions.
Okay, great. Thanks again, Alex.
Okay, you too.